Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every week two nerds get together to rate, read and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm Geordie's Yuletide Shadow Self that remembers the old ways of doing podcasts, Duncan Nicol.
And today, celebrating the, as I've just found out from our Spotify for Creators Wrapped, the country with our fifth largest number of listeners, Germany. This episode is commemorated to you guys, because we are doing Krampus by Brom.
Krampus, the Yule Lord. We found another Christmas book. Thank goodness. We genuinely thought this would be a mine. We would have completely done dry. That's not right. Well, yeah. Well, we would have run dry long ago. We found another fantasy Christmas book, Geordie, and it's not The Grinch.
Even with us doing the, like, dark version of Father Christmas this time, I feel like it would still be too obvious to go to The Grinch. However, I did find out in between choosing this episode that, oh god, what's his name? Frank Baum, who wrote The Wizard of Oz? He wrote a book about the adventures of Father Christmas.
Oh, you have piqued my interest. I actually really want to do The Wizard of Oz. Like, it's been kind of on the periphery of my, like,
I do too,
to cover list for, well, at least 2 years now.
We really should have done it last month. Wicked just came
out. Don't point out to me when we've missed opportunities. But you're absolutely right. No, we like to separate them because we believe in giving the original Wizard of Oz, like, the attention it deserves. It shouldn't sit in Wicked's shadow.
I'm just remembering now that I cut out the, like, almost 20 minutes we spent discussing Wicked for good on our, what was it, Empire of the Vampire? Or was it Fourth Wing episode?
Empire of the Dawn episode.
It was the Empire of the Dawn episode.
There was a very long 30-minute odd section.
No, which it wasn't 30 minutes.
Editing room floor. Felt like it. Probably for the best, though.
Yeah.
You're not missing much.
One of us had a bad opinion.
Right.
Who can say who it was? Now then.
Geordie, before we get into Krampus, is there anything else you've been reading, watching, experiencing that you just want to share with us?
Yeah, there is, actually. I had a very interesting literary experience. It took me a little bit to get through Krampus. We shall discuss why, perhaps. But whilst I was reading this book, I did dip into another one, and I enjoyed it quite a lot, even though it was an unusual experience. I read, Duncan, Jurassic Park by Michael Crichton.
Oh, hello. Obviously, I'm very familiar with the Spielberg movie.
As am I.
But I have to admit, I've never read the original.
It's interesting. It really is. The changes you see between the mediums makes you go, huh, you can really feel the things which Steven Spielberg and Michael Crichton are, they themselves are interested in. There is so much more computer talk in Michael Crichton's book. It's so much of people looking at screens and trying to work out archaic 1990 style big computers. And you can feel the romance, the, like, the glossy layer of Hollywood which, like, Spielberg has put on top, and where that enhances the movie and where it might actually kind of detract from it a little bit. When all said and done, the book does not compare to the movie. The movie is much better, but it was a very enjoyable and interesting experience, if only to see these, like, jagged changes in adaptation. There are, like, rocket launches in book version, and in the film they have, like, a couple of shotguns on the island for that one guy to hunt velociraptors, but in the book they have no guns because Hammond won't allow them. But they do have a lot of nerve gas
because he was concerned about the guests rioting.
It was like, oh, no, we can't possibly shoot these animals, but we can, you know, commit war crimes on the velociraptors. Something else that's very interesting in it is the way in which the book believes it is at the cutting edge of science. Michael Crichton's main skill is very obviously that he's really good at effectively persuading you that the sci-fi stuff he's giving you is very plausible. And you can absolutely believe that if you were in, oh, is it 1989, 1990 when this book came out, you would totally be taken in by this. And it's only the time which has passed which has made you go, what the fuck is going on? And I'm not even, like, the, like, dinosaurs now likely a lot of them being feathered, because he's constantly talking about how they're more bird-like than lizards, and that was the thing he was like really on about. But there's also scenes where they are like, oh yeah, if we find any like bad incomplete bone fossils, we feed it into a macerator so that the machine can try and find trace pieces of ancient DNA. And you go, oh yeah, I can see why they really focused on the mosquito stuff in the movie, because that is so stupid.
I mean, the mosquito stuff is...
It genuinely is silly, but it is such a beautifully...
Come on now.
...elegant solution to a impossible problem. Like, it's magic, right? They got dinosaur DNA because they made a wish on a genie. It makes just as much sense, but the explanation of, oh yeah, a mosquito bit a dinosaur, it had its blood in it, and then it just so happened to then be frozen in amber. It feels plausible, and that's what matters.
Now, that definitely sounds interesting. It's always been on my list, and I always think it's very interesting when you have adaptations of works, particularly in film, where the film then comes far more famous and popular than the original book. I feel like Godfather is another one where I do not get the book recommended to me, ever. And I'd love to go back and see what happens. And it's almost very interesting where I think this whole kind of conversation of, hey, why adapt brilliant books? They're brilliant. They were perfect in the medium. What you should do, you should seek out the ones that were kind of okay and then see if that story can work better in a new medium.
I want to say one more thing about the Jurassic Park book, which, one, made me appreciate Jeff Goldblum a lot, and two, ties into this book, because at a certain point, every time Dr. Ian Malcolm opens his mouth, I would go, shut up, oh my god, shut up, stop yapping, just shut up. It's never ending and it's so pretentious, and occasionally I found myself doing that when I was reading Krampus.
Okay, and are we appreciating how Jeff Goldblum took a character that was probably very unlikable on page and just managed to bring enough charisma to it to win
you
round?
That is certainly part of it. He has a lot of charm, but also he doesn't yap, you know? He has like a third the number of lines, and it's for the best. Now, Duncan, I did do a nice segue into talking about Krampus, but I don't want to jump straight over you. Have you been reading anything else in the meantime?
Well, I have. I have had a bit of a setback into a franchise that I do really love, and I'm working my way through it, and that is the Witcher series. Geordie, as of recording, I have now finished season 4 of The Witcher.
Great.
The first one with Liam Hemsworth coming into the role, and I am going back and just going quite quickly. I have actually read the book before, but I've sort of skimmed it, revisited the Baptism of Fire, which mostly maps onto the fourth season.
Well, Duncan, what do you think of it?
I like it, and I know I'm in a real minority here.
Okay.
But I kind of do. I really don't get the quite intense hate on the Witcher TV show. I don't think I love the original source material as much as obviously a lot of people do, and I think that's a key factor here, that I've sort of bimbled my way through the books sort of in time with the TV show coming out. So it's not like they've ruined this perfect thing for me, that I'm like, no, these are my precious memories. But genuinely, watching season 4 of The Witcher, and obviously you've got to get there, so it's kind of a challenging thing to recommend. I don't recommend you watch season 4, you know, ahead of any of the other seasons. But it really was the best adaptation of the book. Like, it is the most hand in glove bringing the book to screen. And even a lot of the things where I feel like when I was watching the TV show, I was like, oh, this is a bit odd. I feel like they really rushed over that. Then when I was skimming through the book, I kind of went, oh, actually, it did happen that way. And yeah, actually, that was a bit rushed in both formats. There's a big section in the book where there's a group of characters called the Rats, who are these sort of, I guess you call them like Oliver Twist gang with like street urchins who end up leveling up throughout the book and start doing increasingly dodgy and daring things. And in the TV show, me and my partner were watching it, and my partner kept like, I just don't like these characters. I just really like don't understand why our character Ciri in this instance, is like following or hanging out with them. And like, I don't like them. And reading the book, I sort of re-realized, I went, oh no, you're really meant to not like them. That's why. They're meant to be seen as these, like, you know, they start off the kind of more quirky, oh, look at us, we're not really doing any harm, maybe Robin Hood-ish sort of figures. And then you're meant to kind of go, oh no, you are actually on the wrong side of the tracks here. You're leading our main character astray. That is an adaptation choice. And I think it's quite interesting, though, coming off, you're talking about Jurassic Park, because you bring to attention the fact that the film did make changes, which ultimately made it a better product. And I feel like, if in a weird way, having slated a lot of the older Witcher seasons for making changes, the weakest point of this season is because it's pretty darn loyal. And that sometimes leads to pacing issues, or slightly less likable characters, or just a bit of dumb decision making.
No, but I mean, I when it comes to adaptations, we shouldn't hold up books as holy relics that can't be challenged. We should try and identify when things make positive changes. For example, I really like, the book Stardust is pretty good, but the movie's just more enjoyable. It's different. They're different. It's hard to really say which one is superior because they're really doing different things. So you have to appreciate the both of them where they are.
I think the only other thing, and I will get off the TV show quite quickly, is the fact that having watched like a lot of big fantasy TV shows, particularly watching Rings of Power quite recently, you watch The Witcher's most recent season and you go, this does not have the budget. This doesn't look as gloss and glam as end of Game of Thrones, House of the Dragons, Lord of the Rings of Power look. But in that, it sort of, I feel like, just speaks to kind of a lower, grittier sword and sorcery, you know, harkening back to maybe what fantasy shows looked like in the earlier 2000s. I don't know if this sounds like praise.
It doesn't sound like praise.
It has a unique vibe of, it's not epic, it's just doing its thing. And in that, I quite enjoyed going on that journey.
Okay, I mean, Duncan, I know I'm not being a very good co-host right now because I genuinely could not give less of a fuck. And I don't mean it as a harsh indictment of you, I mean it as a harsh indictment of The Witcher TV show.
I guess the final line is, if you'd push through to season 3, you might as well watch season 4, I think it's gotten better. If you watched season 2 and went, absolutely not, probably not worth you climbing back on this wagon.
Season 2, episode 1, and I went, life is so short. And then I went and looked at a rainbow or something. I don't know.
Well, talking about life maybe being too short for things, Geordie, how did you find Krampus Yule Lord?
I may have given a pretty harsh opinion right off the bat when I was saying that it was yappy and I wanted it to shut the fuck up, because that is not the full extent of my opinion. Because to be honest, I have myriad opinions about this book. I think it has some good highs and some really low lows, and it leaves me in a puzzling place.
I would like to say that I think I share that sentiment. I'd be interested to know if we share it on the same points. Yeah. But this was a very mixed book for me. I think there were moments which I was genuinely really enjoying. I particularly liked a lot of the lore aspects and the tying other mythological characters to Father Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
That I found very enjoyable. And there were genuine moments where I felt worried for certain characters. But there were also moments where I felt scenes were dragging on. There were moments where I got the impression I was meant to care more for a character than I was. There were certainly a lot of instances of me standing here and being like, I think all these guys are actually quite unlikable. I really don't mind who ends up dead in this scenario. And I don't think that was the author's intent. I would genuinely say though, Geordie, having finished the book, I don't regret my time with it. I think it ultimately landed positive, but we had a lot of ups and downs on the way.
It goes to show the power of a good ending. Because I think this book has a very good ending, and it redeems a lot. So let's lay out what Krampus the Yule Lord is. So it's by Brom, who is both a writer and an artist, and a very good artist. He's the person, he's done the front cover, but is also illustrations throughout the book, much like Empire of the Vampire books, and they're really excellent. He's a brilliant penman. In fact, I discovered between episodes, Duncan, and shared with you that he's the creator of a very famous and very good Elric piece.
It was actually really fun discovering his artistic library. Artistic library, is that what I'm saying? His artwork. I kind of did a Google and went through Google Images. I was like, oh, there's actually a lot here. He's quite a prolific artist. And that Elric piece in question, people go look it up, type Bron Elric of Melniboné, it'll come up.
He's a slightly more restrained and imaginative Frank Frazetta, you know? He doesn't quite have the same, like, pomp and energy of Frazetta's work, but it's entranced by the strange, and it casts things in, like, a sort of... There's almost a ghostly mist hanging over a lot of his pieces, and it's perfect in tone for something like Krampus. It really goes to show the, you know, the same mind that moves the stylus moves the keyboard as well. Krampus as a book is a reimagining of the lore of Father Christmas and the lesser known holiday figure of Krampus. I made a joke at the start of the episode about this being dedicated to the our German listeners, because Krampus is present in a lot of Germanic cultures. So if you're in last week in Austria, there was Krampusnacht was being celebrated, and my girlfriend Lauren was showing me lots of TikToks of men in Krampus masks hitting people with sticks and carrying away beautiful women. You know, fun stuff like that.
Other cultures.
But on the whole, a lesser known holiday figure than Father Christmas. There aren't any Coca-Cola ads of Krampus in them.
No, but there kind of should be.
Yeah, especially if we're just going to have horrifying AI ads for Coca-Cola and Father Christmas.
No, you know what needs to happen. Coca-Cola has Father Christmas. Pepsi, this is your
Pepsi
opportunity, people.
Has Krampus. Yes! Oh.
I can just see it now. Get some children, put it in the sack, beats them up, and then gives them a nice can of Pepsi afterwards.
It probably would set the Christians off, though, to see a devil man walking around. Anyway, listen, Krampus is a character from Germanic Christmas traditions. He is a devil man who fulfills a similar role to Father Christmas in that he will visit the houses of good boys and girls, and he will leave gifts for the good children, but for bad children he will put in his sack, and he will either beat it with a stick or he will kidnap them, sometimes to hell and sometimes to Spain.
I know which one I'd prefer.
Yeah, he hates paella. Now, Northern Europe has an interesting relationship with Father Christmas. Also on our list of top countries that we have listeners in was the Netherlands, which is a welcome surprise. Hello. And they have some abominable Christmas traditions, Duncan. Duncan, are you familiar with the traditions of celebrating Father Christmas's arrival in the Netherlands?
I don't. I'm nervous that you've called something abominable about another country's culture. I hope you're going to say something pretty intense.
Well, David, the best way to experience this is to listen to David Sedaris's short story about learning this tradition from his cabbie. But to put it quite simply, rather than arriving via flying sleigh in the Netherlands, Father Christmas arrives by boat from Spain, and he arrives with So in the modern day, they're classified as his friends. Traditionally, they are black men, you know, white people with their skin painted black. And previously before, yes, they were his slaves, and they would come, you know, they would help Father Christmas with his jobs. I can't remember if that involved abducting children.
Wow. Folklore is dark, and that is a theme.
I think the story, David Sedaris' story, is called 5 to 8 Black Men.
I don't know how to feed off this, Geordie. I'm glad that they've recharacterized
it. The way we feed off of it.
But I think what we're saying is...
yes, now they're friends.
Real Christmas traditions are dark. Doing dark...
and weird.
Weird Christmas is not new to the world. But I thought this was still an interesting take. This isn't just a regurgitation of the folklores as they're sort of still found. This is a unique story of Krampus that recasts Krampus and Father Christmas, or Santa Claus, for our USA listeners. You guys are still number one, thank you.
Of listeners. Not number one in other regards.
Absolutely not. Rule Britannia. Recast Krampus and Father Christmas as the surviving Norse pantheon in the modern day.
Yes. This was a bold take. Father Christmas has always had a connection, has reputedly, some scholars say, has a connection to Odin and the Wild Hunt. The idea of, like, things rushing through the sky, and, you know, there was there's iconography of sleighs and chariots being pulled by goats in Norse mythology. So this connection has existed before. In the epilogue, not the epilogue, the author's note at the end, Brom makes clear that he knew about this connection to Odin, but decided that the character of Balder was a more appropriate figure for Father Christmas to fill the role of. And one of the best parts of this book is the exploration of this transfer from Old Norse mythology to modern day mythology. How did that happen? And how does it tie into this ancient hatred and rivalry between Father Christmas and Krampus? Because Krampus, despite being a devil man who abducts and beats children, is in some ways the hero of the story, and Father Christmas is nakedly the villain.
And I want to say, I think this is the dynamic that was most interesting as a concept. I was really enjoyed seeing this transition and going through this period of, I'm not sure who I'm meant to like, whose side am I on? There are points where both characters what I think are genuinely good arguments, and both as inspire a level of sympathy, and they're both that both characters are apprehensible, and I'm like, gosh, may the world be a better place without either of you.
There's a really interesting use of the narrative lens of this book and how the perspective changes and how that is used to build intrigue. We are in the very early part of this book, we're moving back and forth between three characters. There's Krampus, who's locked away in a cave, unable to escape. There's Father Christmas, who's just been attacked by what to us appear like some, like, devil men in service of Krampus that are called Bellsnickels. And last of all, there's the actual hero of the story, Jesse. A main character, he's a down-on-his-luck West Virginia singer-songwriter who has a setup that is familiar to a lot of, like, typical Christmas movies, which I think is, like, a cute, kind of clever choice. In that he's, like, estranged from his wife, and he doesn't have a good connection or relationship to his daughter, and he needs to, you know, needs to grow up, and needs to learn his lesson, needs to be a man. He acts as this witness to the preliminary stages of this fight between Krampus and Father Christmas, whilst we're trying to still figure out what's going on. But then when he meets with, like, the Bellsnickels, and, like, he starts to feel the influence of Krampus, Santa's role in the story does this incredibly strange turn, because he's seen, like, a sleigh flying through the sky, and he's seen reindeer, but after we swatch Father Christmas's perspective, Father Christmas is in the woods with a dying reindeer, and he draws a sword and puts the beast out of its misery, and you go, oh wow, that was a weird tone shift, what's Father Christmas doing? And then he summons Hugin and Mugin, the intelligent ravens that belong to Odin, and you go, okay, what the fuck is going on?
I think it's worth mentioning, I actually really enjoyed this level of, this sort of realization of what type of story I was reading. Because I genuinely didn't know. My only real exposure to the idea of Krampus was the Krampus sort of Christmas horror film that came out, I don't know, half a decade ago now. When?
2015, 10 years ago.
Freaking hell, I'm getting old. Yay. So this was kind of a cool bit of intrigue, and I was very excited for this side of the story. But it's not really, in many respects, the main story, or at least it's only about half the narrative. The other half is with the character of Jesse and his sort of relationship with his, how do I put this? No, yeah, his estranged wife and daughter, and the weird Breaking Bad crime cartel, abusive, corrupt cop plot going on that If you, my tone tells you what I think of this, it's like, what is this story doing here?
So, since it's specifically, like, in Appalachia, it's not Breaking Bad. This is, like, Justified. This is a Elmore Leonard story. It's hick crime, dealing methamphetamine, corrupt cops. I should have a lot more tolerance for this because I love Justified. I love Elmore Leonard. God, it was so boring.
I'm happy we're on the same page. Now, I'm not saying that this couldn't work. I'm not saying it was a bad choice to do these two.
It almost did. In the early bits.
But it certainly, I felt, lent itself to a tonal dissonance with the other sort of Krampus half of the story. Because this crime story, which we'll keep cutting back to, and Geordie, tell me if you think I'm completely wrong on this, clearly I'm less familiar with the tropes of this type of story than you are. But it kept being either, even though I'm not super familiar with this type of story, so predictable I was bored, or occasionally so dark and real world like horrific it pulled me out of the whole book.
Or so overly dark and violent that it just strained credulity and made me roll my eyes. Like, there are numerous torture scenes in the first half of the book where the peril is amped up so high that you go, well, the stakes are too high, so it can't happen. This is one of those books where the introduction of the fantastical elements really does undermine the rest of the story, because when they're gonna put Jesse's hand in a drill press and go, you're never gonna play a guitar again because it's gonna destroy your hand, I think to myself, well, only two things can happen here. Either Jesse gives him what he wants to know and they don't drill a hole in his hand, or something intercedes to save him, because his narrative journey obviously is going to revolve around him discovering his art. That's what's been set up. That can't happen if his hand is destroyed. But if his hand is destroyed, well, guess what? Father Christmas is here, and a devil man is here. He can probably just get it healed. So when they do drill a hole in his hand, now, literally a day later within the story, his hand is fixed, and who cares?
It's this kind of odd thing where, as you alluded to at the start of the premise, the start of the story with Jesse, is that it's like the opening of like a classic Christmas movie.
Yeah, this is the opening of Santa Claus, or Jingle All the Way.
Yeah, exactly. So all the times I'm like, well, I'm expecting that general Christmas movie ending as well, which, bit of spoilers, we do get. So all these weird ups and downs in between, I'm like, how am I meant to feel on this journey?
So I will say this, the whole book is deliberately very dark. It's a dark retelling of the lore around Father Christmas, and so the like typical Christmas movie struggles, like a down on his luck father needs to get his daughter like a toy. That's very normal Christmas movie thing. But the darkness gets amped up because that's obviously what Brom is interested in. So it gets roped into, in a typical low stakes Christmas movie, the main character is estranged from his wife and she's met a new man who's more successful than him. Now, in Hollywood, he would be like a slick back hair business guy. He'd have suspenders and he'd play golf on the weekends, you know? Because this is the dark, edgy Appalachian version of the story, he's the corrupt local sheriff, and he, at one point, his confrontation with Jesse is not, Jesse, get out of here, you're a loser. It's, Jesse, I'm going to prove you're a loser because I'm going to put my service gun on the hood of my car, walk away and tell you that I'm about to have violent oral sex with your wife unless you shoot me.
Did it ever put you in mind, and maybe this is an unfair comparison, but when we read The Gunslinger by Stephen King, the first in the Dark Tower series, and you're reading the story and occasionally there's just such a graphic description, there's a scene in that where someone gets run over by a car, and it's so graphic, you're like, oh, I'm out, mate. No.
Yeah. And not even in a way that it's like, oh, that's so unpleasant that that I'm averse to it. It's so over the top that it becomes embarrassing. It's like when someone makes their fantasy hero like so overly strong and badass, and you're like, oh, come on, like this is ridiculous. It's that same sort of you've lost me. You went too far. So when Jesse is, the second time Jesse is tortured in the book by the general, when he's like caught and he gets shot numerous times in his various parts of his body, and you're like, okay, so Jesse's gonna die unless he receives magical healing. So that means Krampus has to appear in the scene so he can give him magical healing, so I know how the scene ends, because otherwise it doesn't work, undermining the tension of the entire scene by building the tension too high. I lost what I was gonna say.
You find it just unbelievable. Your suspension of disbelief is broken. And that ultimately takes you out of the moment.
We talked about a lot of negative stuff.
Yes, let's go into the positives.
Let's talk about something good again, because there is good stuff.
Right, so let's flip back over to the fantastical side. As Geordie said, Jesse, he needs to get a toy for his kid. There's a run-in between these devil people and Father Christmas. How does this play out? Well, Father Christmas drops his magic sack, and Jesse picks it up. And this is a really cool kind of MacGuffin tool for the plot, where Father Christmas's sack is actually, it's Loki's sack. It's how he used to play all those tricks in Asgard.
Yeah.
It's a magic sack where you think about what you want, you stick your hand in, and it basically opens up like a little portal in the bottom of the sack, and your hand comes out wherever the thing is, you grab it, you pull it back out. Cool.
I mean, that's how it works later in the book, when the purpose of a sack completely flips, because the first time that's not how it works, and I know that it was a scene explaining why. It really didn't register to me the explanation as to why it's working differently now. I felt was a bit of a cop out, because the first time it appears, it grants your wish. You don't reach in and pull out a toy. You think of a toy, and you open it up, and it's there, and it has to be a toy. Jesse tries to create money and, like, a Rolex watch, and they always come out as toys. And then later, it turns into a portal. You think of a location, and then you can reach in, and you can take money out of the safe. And that felt a bit incongruous. Because the explanation it's providing is, Father Christmas is using the sack to make toys to give to all the good boys and girls of the world. And that's so when Jesse opens it up, that's what he can do as well. And then Krampus, later he gets and says, oh no, if you have the blood of Loki, you can do its actual function. You can use it to create a portal. So it's like, okay, Father Christmas couldn't do it like that because he doesn't have the blood of Loki. And Jesse couldn't do it because he doesn't have the blood of Loki either. And then Bronn remembers, actually, wait, I need Jesse to be able to use the full function of the sack later as well. So, no, he actually has a bit of the blood of Loki in him, maybe, so he can actually use the sack for its intended purpose and use it to create portals to steal things. So why couldn't he do that the first time?
He's just kind of feeling the hand of the author kind of on the page going, nope, I've got to fix it.
Change course.
And it was a bit silly because I just felt like a little rewrite could have like tidied that up. One thing was obviously they reference how Father Christmas bends the sack to his will. So you could just kind of be like, oh no, he fundamentally changed its function and Krampus changed it back. Or, and this is genuinely where I thought they were going, is that maybe it's just more of a narrative of like, Father Christmas does have his little toy workshop somewhere, but he can't physically carry them all at once. So he is using it as a portal, just a portal to his little toy like conveyor belt. He just goes, yep.
Oh, that is a good thing. That is actually a very good point. I mean, it wouldn't work for the scene where Jesse like summons a bunch of PlayStations and steals those. Now, here's something. This was a place where the book almost got me. Because the first like fantastical element in a book isn't even the presence of Father Christmas and Krampus. They're present, but they're not central to the story yet. The main thrust is Jesse finds the sack. This allows him to like get his daughter not just the doll she wants, but a ton of toys. And the great emotional stakes of that particular scene is He produces like two whole garbage bags of toys for his daughter. He shows them to her. She's ecstatic, and his ex-wife, they're still married technically, but his wife, his estranged wife, is furious because first she's like, where did you steal these from? He says, I didn't steal them. And he says, okay, so if you didn't steal them and we need money, why didn't you spend that money on groceries?
I don't know, that bit hit me. I was like, yeah.
And that was the thing that was really close to working in the first part of his book. The fact that it is set, this isn't just a fancy story. Similar to Shadowhunters, Dresden Files, stuff like that, but it's rural. It's hick fantasy. And it should be, the tension is people dealing with the everyday. It's not just a guy who's down in his luck needs to find a toy. It's a guy who's down in his luck and is dealing with the meth-dealing redneck mafia. You know, the Dixie Mafia's in town and I need to make a drug run for them. That should be exciting and tense. But it's that incongruity. The dark twist of a Hallmark movie mixed with the Dixie Mafia movie, mixed with the Father Christmas movie, mixed with the blending with the like Norse mythology story. There's a lot of stuff going on in this stew.
So let's go over to some more positive bits.
This is a nice positive section, Duncan.
Meaty chunks in this stew. I really liked one character, the character of Isabella, who is one of the Barnstinkers, one of the demons working for Krampus. Okay. And I actually...
Yeah, you go ahead, Duncan. You say your piece.
Oh, no. What have I done now? I know that tone. I enjoyed the fact that we are first presented with these characters... Okay, no, there are issues later. We're first presented these characters as purely as these minions of Krampus. They're sort of... like stormtrooper-feeling henchmen. And I really enjoyed the bit where Jesse kind of first makes contact and all of a sudden they start getting characterization. Slightly, I think, offensive characterization in places and some stereotypes about.
Yeah. There's a section of this podcast just going to be dedicated to that.
But...
And it could be a whole podcast episode, but...
I will say, I like, and I'm going to describe it as the taking off the stormtrooper's mask moment. These were people that I thought were just there to be evil minions, and I did like that we then got introduced to them as characters.
And Isabella is the right character to do that through, because... whilst everyone in the crew is literally introduced trying to chase and murder Santa Claus, which is like a really messed up way to introduce your heroes, right? What a real turnaround if they turn out to be the goodies. But Isabella works great because she feels like a normal person. And when she's speaking to Krampus locked up, it feels like... she doesn't feel like the minion of the evil Dark Lord. She feels like a slightly harassed freelancer being like, yeah, I know, look, we tried to kill Father Christmas, okay, but some stuff got complicated. And the like awkward, well, we kind of know where his sack is, but not really. That stuff was kind of cute. And it was an interesting blending of tones, undermining this like... chthonic darkness of this demon trapped in a cave, which starts to open up. Okay, why are Krampus's minions like this? Why aren't they scary? What are we learning about the character of Krampus that this is the feeling he's generating in his minions?
And I think that's a great point to jump off onto Krampus. So, the title character. And he has this kind of cool mix of what we describe. He is this dark, chthonic, this demonic creature, the haunting presence over the early parts of the story. But then as Jesse engages with the character, he falls in with the Dean Barnstinkers during a drug deal gone wrong. It's a long story. He ends up working with Krampus. And we kind of go back and forth on Krampus being like this character who's all about, he wants to recreate the old days. He wants to be that feared and worshipped figure. But we also...
And specifically when you say the old ways, you mean pre-Christian Yuletide.
Correct. Get back to that winter solstice spirit where humanity was just sitting in the cold, just hoping that the summer times would come again. And I really like the fact that we get this character who has this image that he wants to recreate, and his purpose and his hatred for Santa Claus for stealing it from him. But at the same time, he's made quite human at points. I really like the fact that he isn't infallible. He makes mistakes. He's when he first gets out and sees, like, the he does escape, plot twist. He gets out and starts seeing the modern age. He's baffled by it. He doesn't fully understand, which leads to some lighter bits of comedy. And I really like the fact that he goes through his own journey of being like, oh, is it worth it? What can I really do?
He's a fish out of water. He wants to keep going back to doing his old, I'm going to deliver presents to the good boys and girls and punish the wicked shtick. And he can't, I'm still using, I overused word shtick so many times in the previous episode, often using it wrong, that I'm now embarrassed every time I use it in real life. I also said that's a really good point a lot in the last episode, so don't expect me to say that to you for at least a couple more episodes, Duncan. All of your ideas are terrible, actually.
You can just use words like brilliant, amazing, awesome. You know, I'll accept these tweets.
Nah, I can't do it. Anyway, Duncan, back to your terrible thoughts.
And I like how he is humanized through his self-doubt, through discovering that the world has moved on, and him eventually getting to this point of questioning, wait, what was my mission again? I've had one single drive for years and years and years, and now I've got here. I've got what I wanted, and I'm not sure if I want it anymore or it wants me.
Yes, the crisis of faith that occurs through the book, both in that Krampus has for himself, long after he's become the hero of the story, but also what how we feel about him, because I think this is actually a pretty good example of a genuinely morally grey character. Because a lot of the time, Krampus is absolutely reprehensible. He's a monster. Like, he's a violent killer. He'll rip people apart with his claws. And he threatens to beat a lot of children. But he also loves giving these kids gifts, and he wants to spread good cheer. And at a certain point in the story, we come to understand that his purpose really is to be this spreader of light and warmth and the joy and thrill of being alive. And that joy and thrill of being alive isn't always pleasant, because, you know, the passions of humanity aren't always pleasant. You know, there's just as much darkness at the heart of love as there is, you know, light and goodness and cheer.
I love it when you get philosophical.
Thank you, Duncan. That's an above average point.
No, I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed the fact that the early part of this book presents the character of Krampus as this other, this demon, this creature over there. And sort of the message, his character arc, is discovering he's actually a real reflection of humanity. Or at least what humanity once was. Mm.
His first line, and the first line of the book, is, I hate Santa Claus, which is a stone-cold opener.
It was also hilarious. That was when I read that first line, I was like, am I in for a comedy?
However, much as we have to look at the bright and dark parts of Father Christmas, we have to look at the dark parts of his book, because the whole I hate Santa Claus bit, it really goes on and on, doesn't it? There's a lot of scenes where it's just Krampus explaining with his words why he hates Father Christmas, and like telling extended stories of the lore of how Loki killed Balder, and why he was justified in killing Balder actually, and what happened to Balder in Hell, and why he came back from Ragnarok, and how Krampus found him in the wilderness, and how they had what their relationship was like, and then how Father Christmas betrayed him, explained in not merely boring, because it's literally just information being handed to us, but Jesse is actually bleeding to death in that scene, which means that it's interminably long, because you're like, I kind of want you to focus on the actual tension of the scene and not just what this one guy feels about Santa Claus.
Does it ever, I don't know, surprise you sometimes, particularly when we're reading prose stories? you know, in films, maybe it's a bit different. It depends on the length of the information. But whenever you have a scene where the function of the scene is one character sitting there and another character telling them a narrative, I often get this wonder, it's like, why did you choose to set the scene like this over just kind of flashing back and giving me the events as if they were happening?
Well, I do hear what you're saying, Duncan, as a general rule, and in many cases I would prefer that. I do think the significance of this is that it's a frame narrative, much like, say, Frankenstein. This is Krampus telling his story. It doesn't have the narrators, the narrator backing him up. This is Krampus telling it from his perspective, and Father Christmas gives his own perspective on what happened later. So in this particular instance, I have to say that was a terrible point. But as a general rule, yes, I do understand what you're saying. And the problems with this scene relate to the fact that it is just data. It's just data being presented to us, as opposed to it being conveyed for a compelling, dramatic, interactive story.
Thank you for saying that was a terrible point. I take that on board now. I'm assuming you only said that due to your prior comment about no point can be good anymore. Otherwise, you would have said it was a great point.
That's a terrible supposition.
I do like how you remembered, though, and I'd kind of forgot. You're right. That there is that small quirk to this Krampus retelling his story. Despite, again, in the moment, I found it very long and boring. I did at least enjoy the fact that when Boulder gives his, like, reaccount, having the two perspectives, I'm like, okay, this is how these two people ended up at such different ends. And even gave me a real moment of, I'm not sure either one of you is truly giving me the events as they happened.
Exactly. That's what I really liked. And I wish... this is a strange thing to say. I really wish there was more Father Christmas. I wish there was more Santa Claus in this book, because this weird take on his character. I have to stress this again. Krampus is introduced saying, "I hate Santa Claus," and that's intriguing. And Santa Claus is introduced in this book, running for his life from demons and throwing one of them out of the sky. And then when he appears as an actual perspective character, he kills one of his reindeer, runs into some kids, calls them bad kids, and then throws one of their bikes into a ravine just to be an asshole. And you go, okay, so this is the, Santa Claus hate book. And then a couple of, like, chapters later, he's being nice to old ladies. And you're like, what is this character? Why does he feel so weird? And why did he get hit by a car and was fine? What's going on?
It certainly felt like the differentiation between what is the narrator telling us information and what is, like, Krampus' perspectives kind of overlapped at points. And I don't know if it was simply meaning Brom was trying to show us, you know, the complexity of the character of Santa Claus, or what it felt like to me, that as he was writing the book, he still hadn't fully made up his mind. It's similar to the Father Christmas's sack. How it changes throughout the story. I feel like this is a story that maybe had its kind of first pass, where Brom was still kind of finding the narrative and how he wanted to do characterization. And then when he got to the end, he didn't kind of retroactively go back and, like, align all his pieces. He just sort of went, yeah, that's the good shape of it. Let's go.
I wholeheartedly disagree with that, because my issue with it isn't that I feel like it's being made up. I think Brom definitely has a concrete idea of Boulder or Santa Claus in his head. It's simply underexplored, because Krampus gets to be not merely an occasional perspective character, but Jesse's next to him a lot of the time, observing him, staying bizarrely quiet in scenes you'd think he'd have something to say in, like, say, Father Christmas being killed in front of him, and Jesse doesn't have any lines of dialogue. He's there in that scene, but I've had a whole chapter. He says nothing, does nothing, and then doesn't really have much to think or say about it after he's seen Santa Claus be killed and beheaded. So, that's weird, right? Anyway, the point is that with Santa Claus, there's this one moment right towards the end of the story. Well, no, two-thirds of the way into the story, right before he's killed, where he gets to have this conversation with I think she does have a name in the story, but I've forgotten it, so I'm just going to call her Mrs. Claus, even though she's one of several Mrs. Clauses, because Father Christmas is a Mormon, I guess. And he has this sort of conflict in himself, where he's like, I know I've done a bad thing. Like, I stole something that wasn't mine. This sack belonged to Loki, and Krampus is the last surviving descendant of Loki. And I trapped him in a cave, and that was a real dick move of me, but I also know that I'm a better man than him, because I'm kind and I do these charitable works, but I do that because it makes me happy to make other people happy. So does that make it ultimately selfish?
It's a good question. It genuinely really is. Now, I'm going to push back. I still feel like there is a slight bit of dissonance between the man going, I like to do good things because it makes me feel good, and the man throwing the kid's bike in the ravine. But nonetheless,
shit kid.
Then be the rules. I like this kind of questioning of why he does things. I really like the fact that he talks about Christianity as this thing that he found. You know, he found the story of Christ and how that changed him, and how he sort of, through Christianity, went, oh, this is the new way. I'm going to dedicate myself. Despite the fact that he is literally from an older pantheon, he converted to Christianity. I thought that was a really interesting kind of take.
It was an interesting take. And because in some ways you think like, oh yeah, so Father Christmas, being this figure of Old Norse myth, he's sort of like the various Scandinavian, Nordic and Germanic countries going Christian. You know, they forget the worship of Odin and Woden and Thor, and they say, oh no, we're going to move with the times. We're going to accept Christ. And Father Christmas has done that too. Krampus rejects that wholeheartedly, and he then gets framed as a devil character. What I find interesting about it is that Santa's relationship to Christianity is, on one hand, it's like, yeah, like a lot of converts, he has found comfort in the doctrine. You know, he likes being Christian. He likes being a saint. He likes being Saint Nick. But it feels like what his actual philosophy is, you gotta get with the times. The world has changed. We have to change too, Krampus. And Krampus rejects that so wholeheartedly that this becomes the great wedge between them. And the other interesting thing about this is the fact that whilst Father Christmas is supposedly Christian, he even has like a cross in one of his early scenes when he takes on the guise of Saint Nicholas. He doesn't believe in God, because God is an actual presence in the story, and it's not God.
See, this gave me very American Gods vibes, for better and worse, but it also left me, in many respects, equally confused. I'm like, so is it sort of this sort of idea of like, is this one of those kind of Discworld human belief creates actual tangible deity things, but that's not to say that these deities are the actual creators of the universe, the many manifestations of whatever humanity believes them to be? That's the vibe?
I think that's right, but I think the actual divine creator is in this story, because there is a god, but she's exclusively referred to as a she, and I think she might be the earth.
Sort of like a Gaia position.
Yeah, exactly, and the Norse also had a sort of conception of the earth, which was, powerful and
it feminine. Certainly was interesting to see from that perspective particularly, because then we get Krampus's view on the changing times, and one of the things he actually really kind of hounds on about is the idea that, oh, the strength of the earth is waning. I haven't been here to like welcome in the summer.
Yeah.
Look at what humanity's done to the planet.
Yeah.
Environmental message. I'm like, okay, what are we saying here? Because if there is like a she earth god, but Krampus is saying they're weak, but they appear to be still like the omnipotent god, and I just got a bit confused, Geordie.
This was the part of the story I felt was the most unexamined. Krampus saying, the earth is dying and I need to save it, right before the fight with Santa, it was like, it felt so out of nowhere that I was like, wait, did I actually miss something? That doesn't make any sense. What are you talking about? Because up to now, the motivation has always been, I hate Santa Claus. That's the opening line of the book. Like, you could not state your premise more obviously. It's this, at first, a purely personal vendetta, and then later it becomes about the old ways versus the new ways. Krampus holds to the old, and Balder, Santa Claus, changes and becomes the new. And then it's now like, no, this is an existential threat. The very fate of the world hinges on this fight, and you made the stakes too high. I don't believe it anymore, once again.
I kind of wish they'd left it, and I know I can't impose the story that I wanted to read onto the narrative. That's not fair. But I really thought it would be fun to leave it as a, oh, Krampus has been legitimately screwed over. His revenge quest, like, is clearly motivated, but that doesn't mean he's actually fighting for, like, the greater good, and he's who we should want to win out for humanity. Whereas it kind of really swung in the later bits of the story that that was the stance, that
I don't
Krampus
know.
Being around was better for people.
Well, it's definitely pro-Yuletide. It's like this is cool and good, actually. And you know what? I agree. It looks very fun. I'd love to visit Austria in December and, you know, be abducted by these strange horny men. I've phrased this poorly.
I think you phrased it honestly.
Terrible take. Now then, what was I saying? Yeah, so the conclusion of the story, right? At the 2/3 mark, we've resolved a lot of Jesse's stuff. He hasn't resolved his relation to his wife and daughter. They are being imperiled. I don't even want to get into the sheriff thing. It's just so,
gross.
Yes, it is a compelling threat, but it feels underbaked in a novel where a lot's going on. I don't even want to get into it. The point is, 2/3 of the way in, we've discovered that Santa Claus is Balder. And Balder, in the story, as everyone knows, is immune to all forms of harm. That's why he can get shot and hit by a car and he's fine. The only thing on Earth which can hurt Balder is mistletoe.
In keeping with the myth.
Anyone who's played God of War knows that. When I realise that he's Balder and that the only thing that can harm him is mistletoe, I think, well, that's great. Because obviously, mistletoe is an essential part of Christmas and of modern and traditional Christmas celebrations. What a great way to tie into mythology. Here's like kryptonite is all around us. So there could be a great scene where they're chasing Santa Claus or being chased by Santa Claus, and they break into an office Christmas party, and there's a couple making out under the mistletoe, or Isabella and Jesse run towards the mistletoe and they bump into each other under it, and you'll have a scene of romantic tension because they're under the mistletoe, and they yank down the mistletoe and they, like, I don't know, turn it into knuckle dusters and punch Father
Jordy,
Christmas in the face.
Are you judging it against the story you wish you were reading again?
His weakness is mistletoe. It's not that one spear that killed him. It's mistletoe.
Yes. I was aware of this, it's meant to be all mistletoe, and like you, I was very much thinking, oh, is this going to link in, I don't know if you're familiar with this, I don't even know if this is universal, but like, you put mistletoe above doorways, so is this some like holdout of like how you keep him out or something, I don't know, but I thought they tried to...
Maybe that's how you protect your house from Santa Claus.
I thought this was linking to the fact, because Krampus just say, oh, that myth is incorrectly done. It was just the fact that they used this mistletoe spear in casting the spell. That's what I thought they were saying.
Well, the way you could do it, and maybe this is even literally what was said and I just missed it. In the myth, it is sort of one sprig of mistletoe that, like, doesn't take the pact. And obviously, it's a myth. So, like, the one mistletoe stands for all mistletoe. But yes, you could say, oh, it was literally this one sprig that then Loki took to make a spear and then had Holdo kill his brother with it. Also, Balder, according to like the prophecy of Ragnarok, you know, survives Ragnarok. That's like canon to the myths. But like a bunch of other gods survive. So where's Magni and Morthy? Where are they?
Are those his two cousins?
Are they cousins? Yes, they are.
I don't know. I thought, isn't there meant to be some lore about how they also got tied into like Christian traditions? Oh, it's knocking about the back of my brain.
Magni and Morthy? I don't know.
I will have to look that up some other time.
I guess I'm adding this into the episode in post. Normally I have to do that when I make mistakes or forget what an author is called. Krampus just has the spear. Like, he hid it somewhere. He knows where it is, so he just reaches into the bag and he gets it out, and now he has the only weapon in the world that can kill Father Christmas. And so now there's a sort of tension to the scene. An invincible hero is being challenged with his kryptonite. So even though he's like this very powerful, strong, ancient warrior, how are they going to take down Father Christmas? With immense ease.
Yes, this was surprising. So there's two things I have to say about this. Number one, it did feel anticlimactic, given how much that Krampus and Father Christmas, their rivalry has been built up. I was still quite impressed. I genuinely thought this was going to be the climax. So the fact that it happens 2/3 of the way through the narrative, and then Krampus has to go through his third act, I don't know what my purpose is anymore, sort of depression. That was genuinely very interesting. I'm glad it happened that way. But it meant that this fight, not being a climax, just got shot through. Like you said, Jesse's barely involved. There's not stages. There's no thinking. They both stand off for each other, do some shit talking, and then Krampus kills him.
Yeah, you should at least be a fight, right? Like, at least make it dramatic. Even if you want me to believe that this is, like, the genuine false climax, you know, this is rescuing Princess Leia. Oh, you rescued Princess Leia, but you still have to blow up the Death Star. There's still a third act to come. So this should be, you've done the initial objective. The problem is that Krampus's further objective is re-establishing the traditions of Yuletide, and while some of these scenes are quite good, they are a bit overlong, and they feel directionless, because for most of the time, you're like, well, I don't know what success is supposed to look like. How am I supposed to get a feeling for whether it's working? Now, the scenes where it does turn out that it is working are good and they're satisfying, but going through those bits was really long and tiring. I don't know if you, the listeners, have been paying attention, but this is the only book we've read in December because this took a while. This is not a long book either.
No, this book did not have much in the way of momentum.
Despite all the stuff that happens in it, like, there's so much going on, but it's herky-jerky.
So, just to kind of talk as we move towards the end of the story, I think we're going to hit a couple more, like, the good points, and then we really need to address the elephant in the room.
Oh, yeah.
Krampus, we get these scenes, sorry about good points, mixed points, we get a couple of scenes where he's breaking into different houses, and sort of getting his shock off the modern age. He goes, oh, is it working? Or what can I do compared to the demon of the TV screen?
Mm-hmm.
There's this whole side plot of them rescuing like this little girl whose parents are meth addicts.
Mixed.
And it happens and I'm like, dude, you are cramming things in. Yeah, I can't really talk about it because it just happens alongside so many other things.
Quite, I think, often. He was like riffing on, what was it, the little matchstick girl?
Well, do you know what kept happening, Geordie? They kept having scenes where like Isabella would turn and talk to this child and I go, oh my god, she's still here. I forgot.
This is why when you were talking about Isabella, I was like, because yeah, there are a lot of, she's the only other character in the book who feels like a actual human being next to Jesse. Yeah, Jesse's wife's okay, but she's not in much of the book. And so there are scenes where it's like, oh yeah, it's someone for Jesse to talk to. It's someone for Krampus to talk to. That's a good utility character. when it's like, Jesse, could you please sit down? It's time for me to tell you about my tragic past in two separate instances. And I go, oh my God, stop yapping. I don't care about your terrible, tragic birth.
It's one of those things I feel like you could have said a lot less and maybe had more impact.
Yes.
For example, I don't think I needed to hear as much about how Isabella had this sort of traumatic relationship with her parent, with her spouse, with the birth of her child. If just by showing how Isabella acts around the child they find who like doesn't have a good parent, you know, and even if Jesse just has a few lines to point it out to the really dumb people reading the book like me, to be like, oh, wow, she must have had it. So, like, leave it in mystery, but through how she cares and what she cares about and how she explains her emotion in the present, you can glean that she's had some traumatic experiences around these subject matters in the past, rather than, as Geordie said, too literal, let's sit down at the campfire while I tell you my backstory.
Yeah, yeah, it's the least interesting way to convey this stuff. Either have it, like, play out in actual dialogue where Jesse has input, and or Krampus has input, like anyone else. I guess now we're talking about the Bellsnickels.
Yes, we are.
So let's go through it one by one. Jesse gets turned into a Bellsnickel, and he becomes much less interesting, and he was already not that interesting. Isabel is fine in small doses. There is a guy from the early 20th century whose name I cannot remember for the life of me. Maybe Charlie. He is so boring. Then there's Chet. Chet has one personality trait. He's very boring. Oh, and who's left? Who's left in the Bellsnickels? Oh yes, it's the racial stereotypes.
Yikes.
Now,
it's not so disappointed by 100%
this. 100% yikes, right? It's 90%.
No, it's not Robert E. Howard yikes, but we have had 100 years since then.
Yes. There's a lot of bad stuff here. So, we're doing this a lot this episode. Positives and negatives. So, Krampus's Bellsnickels are people that, like a vampire, he charms them. They drink of his blood, and now they have to follow him. And because he's been in the Americas for 500 years, why 500 years? Well, that's because 500 years ago, in our history, is when you start to get the emergence of the modern idea of Santa Claus. Okay, so that's the period of time where Krampus and Santa Claus need to have their falling out. Why does he have to be in the Americas? Well, he has to be in the Americas because that's where Jesse needs to find him. Okay, so he has to be in the Americas 500 years ago, and he has to have servants who can visit him in the cave, who are the only people in West Virginia 500 years ago. It's the indigenous, I was going to say indigenous West Virginians. No, it's the indigenous Americans. It's the, and it's specifically, this is the positive. They're exclusively referred to by their nation, their Choctaw, and they only get referred to as Choctaw. And the only people who refer to them as Indians are racists. So in that way, it's like, all right, yeah, good job. It is specifically this group who were living here, and they're the indigenous group to the area. Okay, that's one positive point. Are there any others?
No. I'm going to go with no. Is no the right answer?
There's a lot of stereotypes going on.
Are you telling me there's no other positives about?
It was Mukto, I think.
And what, Nippy?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I genuinely, all the positive traits are in one guy. Because Mukto is at least treated with some respect, but in the same way that it's like, oh, the stoic Native American guide character from like early Hollywood. It's like, is this technically like the narrative likes him and we are told to like him and therefore he's a good guy? Yes. Is it relying on like kind of like really tired stereotypes of this guy being like tied to nature and being quiet and stoic? This dude is 500 years old, and they say, like, oh, he hasn't learnt much English, and that's why he doesn't talk much. And I think to myself, he has been speaking English for longer than you guys! He's 500 years old! He has spent the overwhelming vast majority of his life in a period of time where his country was being colonized by English speakers. If you really wanted to have him not talk much in the story, then why not say, oh, he does speak... He doesn't just speak his native tongue, but he only speaks an archaic form of French, which none of us understand. And he refused to learn another language because he felt like he was really compromising the first time when he learnt that.
I mean, yes. Sorry. I'm just thinking how that would have been quite brilliant. They don't give any respect to the age of these characters. And they don't... And this is what really annoyed me. I don't feel they were being treated like human characters.
No, they sure weren't.
There were cardboard stereotypes that were given a proper name. That's not enough.
Yeah, it's not enough. It feels like a real unforced error. Like, I started with that whole thing about why it makes sense, you know? Because that would be, if you're an ardent defender of this, that would be what you go for. There's a reason why that Bronn decided Krampus was locked in this cave at that period of time. So a character has to be around for him to do that. Now, here's my answer to that, right? You've got Krampus, this figure from Germanic folklore, who you've decided is from Old Norse mythology in North America. Okay, make one of his servants a Vinlander. This dude isn't 500 years old, he's 1100 years old. It's good old Svensson. He's been in Canada for 1,000 years in the service of Krampus. And you can have him be strange and alien because he's 1,000 years old and he's more like an elf than a human at this point. But he wouldn't be an old, tired, offensive stereotype.
I mean, the other approach is to just, you know, give more of the Barnes Nichols characterization. Not that this book wasn't already overcrowded.
Let's talk about the very last part of the book.
Yes, which you said you liked, and I did too.
A good ending can solve a lot. Now, not everything in the ending is perfect. I really didn't care for the resolution of Jesse being a man. The first part of the book, Jesse is being told by other men, the way in which you need to express yourself as a man is through violence. And right at the start of the book, Jesse is unable to follow through in that violence. And the other characters are saying, that's a weakness, that proves you're a loser. I was wondering, you know, violence throughout this book is shown as this appalling thing. Like, the fact that Krampus is so monstrously violent and he rips you apart with his claws is bad. The thing that makes us suspicious of a beloved character like Santa Claus is that he's violent. So maybe the book is saying that Jesse succumbing and becoming this violent person would undermine him. It wouldn't make him a good partner for his wife and a father to his child, even if he's attacking their abuser. You know, even if it didn't make him as bad as the sheriff, wouldn't it still mean that he was a dangerous man and not someone that they could trust to look after them? Well, no, that's not the answer, because the resolution of his character arc is he kills that guy in cold blood. He feeds him straight to hell.
It certainly isn't the Wizard of Earthsea. This is not going for the true victory is through pacifism and rising above the violence. And that was kind of a shame, because you're right. I really thought that was the setup, that was the message. And I really left a bit of a sour taste that I'm like, oh, the message was he standing up to bullies? Because it's not about the violence, it's about, you know, standing up for yourself and what you believe in. But that is a different message.
It's having your cake and eating it too. Because in an unbelievably clunky scene, the character of Chet, he's not even speaking to Jesse. He's speaking to the guy standing next to Jesse, knowing that Jesse is there. Knowing that Jesse, there's a possibility that he was going to talk to law enforcement, and that's why he just got that hole drilled through his hand. So knowing that Jesse is a potential snitch, he says to the guy standing next to Jesse, "Hey, did you hear about how the sheriff murdered his wife and where you can find the evidence and maybe her body?" So the setup, which is so nakedly obvious, is Jesse will find the way to lead the police to the sheriff. He's not going to choose the way of violence. He's going to craftily figure out a way to bring him down without succumbing to his level. He's going to stay pure whilst doing the right thing and standing up for himself. But instead, Jesse goes to his house. He's put in a position where it's morally justifiable to, like, take this guy down. And then he literally feeds him to hell. And then he gets the evidence, and then he brings down the whole gang by handing it over to the authorities.
I mean, I don't want to, like, undermine myself here. There was something somewhat cathartic. I did really hate this sheriff character. So seeing him get his comeuppance and get a fate sort of worse than death.
Yeah, maybe.
There's some catharsis to that. And I did like seeing that play out. It just wasn't the ethical messaging I thought we were going for. And not what I thought I was going for, but what I felt like Bron was setting up and trying to teach us a lesson about. That he undermined at the last moment to go for this kind of cathartic feeling for the reader instead.
It almost feels like it could have been a sort of Indiana Jones ending, you know? Where it would be the sins of the others that would undermine them. It would be the hunger for, it would be the greed of wanting, say, the sack, which Jesse is able to give up. Which when Santa Claus comes back for, Santa Claus comes back to life because, you know, he's Boulder, the guy who's supposed to come back to life, comes back and says, "I want the sack." I actually really liked the climax of Jesse just gives it over. He doesn't make this grand stand. He doesn't try and run. He doesn't try and fight. He just says, "I'm beat. Have it back." I actually thought that was good. I genuinely was like, yeah, that's a good undermining of my of the tension of the scene. It feels striking and dramatic and sad and forlorn.
It's great because Krampus's last words to Jesse before the character Krampus gets killed off by Santa Claus when he comes back from the dead is like, he's like, "Don't let him have the sack, Jesse. Whatever you do, don't let him have the sack." And you're like, okay, Jesse's going to carry on the fight. Jesse's going to embody Krampus. Jesse's going to be the one that's going to keep this war going. And it is incredible to have the nerves like, no, like, we've lost the charismatic leader. This isn't my war. I'm out.
And yeah, this is a moment where Jesse gets to make a big decision about the story. You know, he at this point, he's finally got his agency back. He literally has free will again after being enslaved by Krampus. And he starts being able to make his own decisions. He follows his dream of being a musician again. He believes in himself. He murders the sheriff. And he gets to make the decision to say, no, I'm done with this. I choose to quit. You know, like it was said in The Worm and His King, sometimes giving something up takes way more courage than carrying something on. And I just liked that part. But I really, really liked the ending. The final format.
So,
yes, go ahead, Duncan, please, go ahead.
Oh, no, I don't know, I've got to take it away now. So this final ending has a beautiful kind of bittersweet vibe to it. As we sort of skip over, firstly, Jesse's life. You know, he believes in himself now. He's going to do it. He's going to follow his musical
he's
career.
He's going to go to Nashville.
He's going to make it work with Linda. It'll be hard, but you know what? We'll get there. We'll work through somehow together. We'll do it. And then as we kind of pan over the township, we see that although Krampus has...
The following year.
Krampus is now dead. We see the influence he's sort of left in the people. The fact that, in many respects, he still had a victory, because what he wanted was to resurrect the old beliefs, and in a small way, he has.
Yeah, the people of Boone County, they celebrate Krampusnacht now. You know, they remember he's reawakened in his strange, weird rituals that they found quite scary. These are old traditions. They stay up all night dancing. They carry off buxom wenches and hit people with sticks. They let the children leave out their shoes. And it's a very sweet conversation where, you know, a little girl and a little boy ask their mum, "Mum, do you believe in Krampus?" And she gives the exact same coy answer which a mum would give about Santa Claus. And you're right. You made a terrible point, but Krampus is it's a subtle victory. It's a small little triumph. And there's this moment where the camera, so to speak, takes us outside a cave, and there's like this stirring in the snow, and we wonder to ourselves, does this little fragment of belief in Krampus, after he's been killed to a permanent end by Santa Claus in revenge, is Krampus back? Like, could this bring him back to life? Or is it just like a tiny aspect of Krampus which cannot be put down?
It's sweet, and it's nice, and it's, I'm not gonna lie, very, very cinematic is a kind of good way to put this. Like, I could see, you said it yourself, like, the camera pans back, and, like, that's how I felt this. This is the end of my Christmas movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the post-credit scenes, the little sting to make you think, you'll return in Krampus Nux 2, this time it's personal.
And that, genuinely, and this is good, small things here, it gave me the buzz of the Christmas spirit. There is a solstice celebration, a Yuletide, a midwinter coming together feeling that this book left me with.
You know what, same.
Which I liked, and it's really hard to come to the end of this and talk about recommendations and who I recommend this book to, because the lows are really low, but I still didn't regret my time with this book.
No.
But I do find it hard to recommend to anyone. Put it this way, talk about recommendations. I wouldn't recommend this book to anyone. But if someone came up to me and said, "Hey Duncan, I've just heard about this Krampus book, or saw that Krampus movie, I've got this book here. Did you enjoy it? Would you recommend I read it now that I already have it?" I'll go, yeah. Some mixed bag, but give it a go. Let me know what you think.
This is something I'm finding it hard to say this. This is one of the few books you can kind of skim. If you're finding a scene boring, you can skim a bit. Because good stuff is probably coming. Do I recommend the book? I'm in a similar boat. As terrible as your point was, I think you might have been onto something. If you really like Justified and Ozark and other, like, Dixie Mafia stories, if you want more rural takes on, you know, urban fantasy, monsters running around in Appalachia, yeah, this might be for you. Because you have to like those sections. If you don't like them, you're not going to enjoy the cool stuff. And if you're a really big, like, Norse mythology nerd, this is a pretty good reimagining. I really thought that, for the most part, he was doing a really good job of blending this folklore. And in the author's note at the end, he actually does a really good job of sort of laying out his almost citations. Like, why are they called Bellsnickels? And why are there angels in the book? Actually, no, that's something I really didn't like. He made a very compelling case in the author's note about why are there angels. But this really ticked off a huge pet peeve of mine, Duncan, regarding the angels and Norse mythology. Can you tell him what I'm about to say?
Does he draw a comparison between angels and the Valkyrie?
Exactly. And I hate that. Angels and Valkyries are not... They're not the same. Valkyries are not described as being winged. And angels aren't even always female. Like, I don't think there's many that actually are depicted as female. And Valkyrie are always female. They're part of a like, trope of fate-defining women in Norse and, like, Germanic mythology. There's a reason why the Valkyrie, their name means? It means, like, slaughterer-picker. It means chooser of the slain. They say, oh yeah, it's your time to die, and then you have an ill fate in battle. And the Norns decide fate as well. You know, they're like the... Anyway, I don't like it when Valkyries get called angels, because they're not. They're a different thing, and they aren't winged.
Well, always good to end on a positive note. Jordy, this has been the Christmas season. Looking onwards now. Now, if one, as is our yearly tradition, there shall be a end of year review for 2025, where we'll talk through our worst, most disappointing, most surprising, our favourite, and inevitably our best books of the year that we have reviewed.
Do we do the most surprising?
Yeah, I think we do. We do. Pleasant surprise. A book that you... Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, fine. Whatever. I genuinely...
Question our format. I wrote it.
I genuinely couldn't remember what we did in the year review, so thank you for the reminder. It's been a weird year, y'all. It feels very short and extremely long.
Looking back to doing The Last Wish at the very start of the year and books like Black Company, oh, so long ago.
Yeah, that's weird. It feels like a...
I cannot wait to talk about this year. I certainly feel like we've done a lot more off the beaten track books this year compared to previous years. Not as many, you know, commercial big hitters as we have been wont to do.
Probably.
So can't wait to review the whole year. But it's not just about the review. It's also about the book we'll be reading for our next episode, kicking off 2026. And I have the pleasure this year of picking that first book.
You get to draw first blood, Duncan.
So I have been going back and forth and back and forth, but in the spirit of doing something a bit different, doing something fresh, and ultimately fulfilling a promise to my partner's cousin when I borrowed this book from them maybe 18 months ago now, I would like to for us to review A Hero Born, the first in the Legend of the Condor Heroes by Yin Yong.
Oh!
I hope I pronounced that right.
I think I know this. No, wait, I don't think I do. What is this? is this a Chinese series of books?
It is indeed. It's a... I'm really sorry for the pronunciation. A Wuxia novel.
Wuxia.
Wuxia. Yeah. So, think of martial arts, mate.
Yeah, Wuxia's like a genre of... Well, I think it was a genre of film... But I've never read a Wuxia book, so I guess we're gonna see. But if you think of like people dressed up in Qing Dynasty things, so they have the long like skirts and the ridiculous bowl cuts with ponytails, it's supposed to be that sort of aesthetic and chic. Man, I'm gonna have to really break out a pronunciation guide for this coming episode, aren't I?
Oh, you definitely are. I really am looking forward to your support on this.
Oh, yeah, it's all on me now. Well, Duncan, genuinely I am looking forward to that, because that is going to be a totally fresh and new take. Like, the closest we'll have come to that is, like, the Poppy War. That was a long time ago, and it was Chinese mythology presented for a Western audience about a subject which Western readers are already familiar with, World War II. So this is going to be a completely different beast, and I'm looking forward to that.
This is indeed, and I can't wait to talk about you. This is from a very different perspective. This was written by a Chinese author in like the 1950s
save it for next time,
in Hong Kong. Sorry, I'm excited for it. Can't wait to see you all then. Next time on the podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, if you've read Krampus yourself, if you know more about the myths and legends, or have enjoyed this book, or any of the other books we've read or reviewed this year, let us know your thoughts. The best place, as always, is our Instagram, This Is Fantasy Podcast. You can also send us a detailed message at our Gmail, thisisfantasypodcast@gmail.com. We're also on Blue Sky at Just Fantasy. And please, if you've enjoyed this episode, whatever podcast listening application of choice, take a moment now, give us 5 stars or 4, you know, I don't mind. And
I do.
Leave us
five
a comment
stars.
Let us know your thoughts.
Until next time for our year in review, I've been your host, Jordy Bailey.
And I've been your other host, Duncan Nicol.
Happy holidays.
Bye.